and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Today, we bring you the first of two parts of an exclusive interview with America's most famous public intellectual, Professor Noam Chomsky. Chomsky talks about the Bernie Sanders campaign, whether a political revolution is on the agenda in the United States, the rise of Donald Trump, and why the U.S. political establishment is in crisis. Libya is now in fragments. Will there be a new government of national unity? Having the largest oil reserves in all of Africa, Western powers are making a move to consolidate their position in this country that has been ravaged by militias and infighting since the NATO destruction of the government of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Billionaire Donald Trump is on the march, having won 3 out of the 4 first Republican primaries, and the Republican Party establishment is trying to stop him. Big money and big endorsers flow to Marco Rubio in an effort to stop Trump, but is it possible? But first, we go to the first part of our exclusive interview with Professor Noam Chomsky. Professor Chomsky, Bernie Sanders' campaign has taken everyone by surprise. Maybe it's taken him by surprise. It's certainly taken the Democratic Party establishment by surprise. No one expected he'd be where he is today. He has tens of thousands of people in some instances coming to his campaign rallies, millions of small donors. He's ahead in the popular vote, although far behind in delegates, probably because of superdelegates. He says that students should go to school and it should be free, that student debt should be lifted, that affordable health care should be a right. And he also calls for a political revolution. What do you think about that? I mean, that's something quite new in the American electoral scene. What is a political revolution? What is the significance of Sanders' campaign? What are your thoughts?
The only thing that I think should be qualified is the phrase political revolution. What he's actually calling for is what was pretty well understood and accepted in the 1950s. In fact, President Eisenhower wouldn't have been much surprised by his proposals. Fundamentally, as I read his positions, a New Deal Democrat, traditional New Deal Democrat, in the fact that it's his and his positions are have been supported by a considerable part of the population, often large majorities, for decades. So he's putting forth positions which are very familiar among people's attitudes, in fact, often strongly supported. It takes a national health care. Right now, about 60% of the population support it, which is pretty remarkable when you think that nobody publicly advocates it. Every time it's brought up, it's denounced. But still, considerable majority supports it. You go back a little further, say to Reagan years, about 80% of the population thought it ought to be guaranteed by the Constitution. In fact, about 40% thought it was guaranteed by the Constitution. These are long, and the same as it takes a free education. But that's what it was like in the 1950s, virtually. The GI Bill gave not only free education, but even subsidies to huge numbers of people, veterans, who would never have gone to college. It was very good for them, very good for the country. It's part of the reason for the very high and relatively equitable growth rate in the 50s and the 60s before the neoliberal reaction set in. It's common in other countries, rich countries like Germany, poor countries like Mexico. These are hardly surprising positions, but in the fact that they're regarded as extremist or that it calls for a revolution is actually a comment on how the spectrum within the mainstream has shifted to the right during the neoliberal years.
Indeed, we have the At one time, you couldn't call yourself a communist during the witch hunt. Then you couldn't call yourself a socialist. Then in the 1980s and 90s, after Reagan, the L word, the liberal word, also was banished. All of the progressive words associated with social change or social justice or even traditional Democratic Party mainstream programs were exorcised from the political lexicon. So now you have somebody calling himself a democratic socialist, which was one of those banned terms, saying, okay, we should have these programs, which are essentially liberal programs. But the entire Democratic Party establishment and, of course, Wall Street seemed completely alarmed. Does it take a political revolution to get back to even mainstream politics?
No, I don't think it takes a political revolution. I think it takes a return to a situation which was far from radical. So, for example, just to illustrate, back in the 1950s, a common quip about the political system, not inaccurate, was that the United States is a one-party state, the business party, which has two factions called Democrats and Republicans, which differ somewhat. If you take the situation today, it's still a one-party state, the business party, but it only has one faction, and it's not Democrats. It's moderate Republicans who call themselves Democrats. If you take a look at today's Democratic Party, it's pretty much what used to be called moderate Republicans. Meanwhile, the Republicans have simply drifted off the political spectrum. They're not a political party in any recognizable form.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because you have Donald Trump. I mean, it's amazing, actually. Donald Trump, he had commanding lead in South Carolina. He won in New Hampshire. He may, to the surprise of all conventional wisdom and the pundits and certainly the Republican establishment, he could actually take the nomination. Now, you have Trump calling for building a wall at the U.S.-Mexican border. He says, like the Israeli apartheid wall. He says, ban Muslims, deport 11 million immigrants. Yesterday or a few days ago, he said the protesters at his rally should be taken out on a stretcher like the good old days. I mean, do you see in Trump, of course, there's a deep strain of white supremacy in America, but do you see with the Trump campaign and the surprising results, the danger of some sort of neo-fascist or fascist kind of movement, or is it something else?
Well, first of all, when you speak about the Republican Party, I'm actually speaking about the Republican establishment being off the spectrum, not Trump. That's an interesting phenomenon, but a different one. So take somebody like Mitch McConnell, who's considered a Republican moderate. What was his reaction to Obama's election? It was very clear. He said, we have to have one policy, no. Anything that the government proposes, we say no, and we block it, because we want to take power. That's not parliamentary politics. And in fact, this is recognized. Some of the most respected conservative political analysts, Norman Ornstein, Thomas Mann of the American Enterprise Institute, right-wing think tank, they simply described it, not Trump, they're talking about the mainstream, they described today's Republican Party as, in their words, a radical insurgency which has abandoned parliamentary politics. And I think the reason is pretty clear. As the both in the United States and in Europe, and in fact everywhere where neoliberal programs have been imposed, there's an undermining of democracy. That's one of their aspects. Could go into it, but it's almost automatic, and you can see it happening. One consequence of that is that the sort of mainstream center begins to collapse, and you get uprisings at both what are called both extremes. One of them is a far-right extreme. The other is called left. It's actually kind of center-left, social-democratic, like Sanders or Corbyn and so on. Nothing particularly radical about it. As the parties have shifted to the right, the Republicans became so dedicated to the interests of extreme wealth and power that they simply cannot get votes on their own programs, and they therefore had to mobilize sectors of the population that have always been there but hadn't been mobilized as a political force. So a substantial plurality, maybe even majority, of Republicans are evangelical Christians, extremist, fundamentalist Christians, you know, people who think the world was created a couple of thousand years ago.
Can you see a Donald Trump presidency?
Can I see it? I think it would be, if he means what he says, not just the things you mentioned, but much more serious ones, it's virtually a death knell for the species. Every Republican candidate in the primaries, and Trump specifically, deny that global warming is taking place, or at least that we should do anything about
it. And Michelle Bachmann said it was, she was the one who admitted it in 2012, and she said it was God's punishment for homosexuality or something like that.
I mean, she's far off the spectrum, but I'm talking about the mainstream. All of them say either it's not happening or we shouldn't do anything about it. And they're acting to try to undermine anything that might deal with it even moderately. So, for example, take the Paris meetings last December. They weren't marvelous, but they achieved at least something minimal. They were hoping to achieve a treaty with commitments that would be fixed and verifiable.
For emissions.
But they couldn't, and it was very clear why they couldn't. In fact, it was recognized in the mainstream press. Republican Congress wouldn't permit it. They will not permit a verifiable a treaty. So what you have is voluntary agreements. The Supreme Court, just a couple of weeks ago, the right-wing justices, at that time there were five, now four with Scalia's death, they violated long-standing precedent, went out of their way to effectively block efforts to reduce emissions from coal plants. They gave arguments, but the reason is, the fundamental reason is just the unwillingness of today's Republican organization, I hesitate to call them a party even, to address this question. This is critical for the survival of the species. I mean, support for torture is bad enough. The idea of getting Mexico to build a wall is grotesque. But this is lethal. And why is it happening? Well, I think we have to ask, where is the support for Trump coming from? If there isn't careful data, but it seems to be substantially lower middle class, relatively uneducated, white males mostly. These are the same sectors of the population that are suffering something unprecedented in modern history, increase in mortality. That's an astonishing fact. The latest Nobel laureate in economics got his prize for recognizing it, but it's much more widespread. These are sectors of the population who see no hope. Their lives have been, the neoliberal programs have led, as elsewhere, to pretty much stagnation for even decline for large parts of the population, alongside of accumulation of spectacular wealth in a tiny sector, which has become a kind of a different society. They're separated from the mainstream society. The hope for the future has declined for the first time, maybe in history. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Depression, which was objectively much worse than today, but it was a hopeful period. My relatives, you know, unemployed factory workers and so on, lived at a level of poverty much beyond anything today, but they expected that the future would be better. Things were happening. CIO organizing was taking place. It was a relatively sympathetic administration. Moderate social democratic programs were being instituted. It looked as if somehow we'll get out of this. That's not the attitude today. The people who are coming to the Trump rallies, as far as you can tell, are people to a large extent who feel that Everything's been taken away from them. And there is, as you mentioned, a strong element of white supremacy. One demographic fact is that the white population pretty soon, you know, in the foreseeable future, will actually be a minority. So they are taking our country away from us. There's always been, way back, a bitter anti-immigrant extremism. The first, apart from Oriental exclusion, you know, the first major immigration bill in 1924, after the First World War, was pretty much aimed at Italians and Jews. They called it Eastern, Southern, and South, Eastern European and South European, but that meant Jews and Italians. That's one of the reasons why plenty of Jews ended up in gas chambers. They couldn't get here. And that went right through to, after the end of the war. It's, if you go back earlier, right here in Boston, when the Irish immigration came in the late 19th century, you could see signs on restaurants saying, "No dogs are Irish." Irish were treated like African Americans, which is the absolute bottom. And this goes way back. We're here, we don't want you, you know. And Europe, it's even worse. I mean, I think Europe is probably more racist than the United States. You can see it right now. But this is real, and this is part of the cheering for Trump when he says build a wall. And if you think about it, what is that wall supposed to do? In fact, what is Obama doing? Obama has been pressuring Mexico to keep the Central Americans away from our border. Why are people fleeing Central America? Because the U.S. destroyed Central America, especially under the Reagan years.
Thank you very much. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. And clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. Libya's parliament is set to meet today to attempt to bring together rival factions in order to keep the country together. The meeting comes as proposals are being floated in Italy, the former colonizer of Libya, to partition the country into three parts. Will Libya be able to survive as a united country? 4 years, 5 years after NATO bombed the country, thousands of bombs and missiles, and overthrew the government of Muammar Gaddafi, we are joined from London by political analyst and activist Sukant Chandan, who visited Libya on three occasions in 2011 on peace delegations. Welcome, Sukant.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Help the audience. We have a U.S. audience. We have a global audience. Libya is not really in the news, at least in the corporate-owned media here in the West, but help our audience understand what's actually at play with this effort to form a government of national unity, and is it possible?
Well, yeah, in your introduction, you said that the Libyan juntas or administrations are meeting today to try and unite the country, but also in your introduction, you somewhat contradicted that. And I know you didn't. It's not an intentional contradiction, but it's a very violently contradictory situation, because whereas the Western mainstream is saying they're meeting to try and unify the country, at the same time, as you mentioned in your introduction, there's plans afoot to formally dividing Libya into the three colonized colonial sections, which is basically the British had the section around Tripoli, the Italians had the section around Benghazi, and the French had the southern section called Fezzan. Towards the Sahel belt of the country. So really, again, if we go back to 2011 with the NATO and the Allied supremacist death squad intervention and destruction of the unified Libya since 1969 revolution of Muammar Gaddafi, of the Jamhuriya, Muammar Gaddafi and his colleagues and all the Libyans who were fighting against NATO made it very clear that if they weren't victorious in their resistance against NATO, that the country would start falling apart. And not only is there imperialist plans at partitioning the country into three, but since 2011, we can see the de facto partitioning of Libya into hundreds of death squad dominated little mini fiefdoms. You know, there's bigger death squad alliances and movements afoot, but basically you've got scores and scores and scores. I mean, it's literally every postcode has its own militia in Libya now. So now, what actually is at foot? What's the underlying things going on here? That's the question we have to ask, because everything that the mainstream is saying is just deceit and a cover-up for what's actually afoot. Now, why hasn't the refugee crisis from Libyan shores been in the news for a good 6 months? It's just disappeared. The reason is that the waters off the Libyan coast are being militarized by the imperialist powers. We have, and this is basically not reported in the media, but we've got the Italian military navy, the British navy, the German navy, the US navy, the Spanish navy, and other navies all jostling for influence off the Libyan coast. Why? Because they are still salivating at the hydrocarbon riches of Libya, which they're jostling to dominate and monopolize. They're not going to go to war with each other, the imperialists. They haven't since 1945. I don't think they're going to do it again, because every time they've gone, half the world turns anti-imperialist and socialist. So they are jostling by proxy and hiding what's actually happening from the public. Because if the public knew, then the whole scam would be exposed.
I want to read a quote to you from John Kirby. He's the State Department spokesman, I think former admiral. The United States welcomes the February 23rd endorsement for the cabinet of the Government of National Accord signed by a majority of the Libyan House of Representatives members. We are deeply concerned by reports that a small, hardline minority used physical intimidation and threats to disrupt the February 23rd session of the House of Representatives in Tobruk in order to prevent a vote on the cabinet. We strongly condemn all attempts to obstruct the Libyan political process. Outside of the diplomatic language there, the U.S. government is saying, we are for a government of national unity. We want to keep the country together under a government of national unity. We oppose those forces who are using armed tactics or intimidation to disrupt the ability of a government of national accord. Is that bogus?
Well, how bogus can you get? How low can you go? Wasn't it physical intimidation by the greatest military alliance that humanity has ever seen that destroyed the unity of the Libyan nation and people in 2011 itself? So now the United States to come with such rhetoric is just absolutely laughable. What's going on again is the United States is trying to muscle in on the Libyan hydrocarbon monopoly. Now, as I mentioned in a previous interview with you, Brian, That jostling for influence during 2011, during the NATO bombing, was evident. The French and the United States and the British military brass and the political leadership were openly bickering with each other in the press. So now, you know, this is continuing. And also, as Syria starts to wind down, as the Syrian government with their global partners are seeing victories and the end in sight, many, many challenges remain. Much blood is still yet to be spilled, no doubt, in Syria. But the end is in sight. And as that winds down, where do you think all these death squads are running to? They're running to the other big base for them, particularly Daesh, but other death squad factions as well, which is INSERT, the former headquarters of the African Union and the historic homeland or birthplace for Muammar Gaddafi and his family. So this is what's at foot. Lots of deceit are going on. And also, you know, the West needs a fig leaf of international legal legitimacy to openly intervene in Libya to pursue their strategic interests there. And so that's why they need these two juntas in Tobruk and Tripoli to sign some kind of unity deal so they can facilitate their entry. Of course, we know that the special forces, the military intelligence, and the mercenaries of Britain, France, United States, Italy, and others were there in 2011 since February. The SAS were caught red-handed in Benghazi, you remember, the first few days of the rebellion in February 2011. And they've been there. It's been reported again in the mainstream press that the French special forces are in and around Benghazi conducting operations as well. So this is the kind of dirty game that's going on right now.
Help us also understand what the political differences or similarities are between the two power centers, or I guess it's three when you include Islamic State, so-called ISIL, Daesh, that controls Sirte, as you said, formerly Gaddafi's hometown and sort of an anchor for the Libyan revolution. You have the General National Congress, that's the body in the government in Libya, and then there's the Tobruk-based government, the Council of Deputies. What's the similarities? What's the differences? Just explain who they are, if you would.
The Tripoli junta is dominated by the Misrata death squads. It's more kind of Islamist-oriented, somewhat close and akin to the Ikhwan Muslimin, the Muslim Brotherhood type of movement. Tobruk is more a nationalist. I mean, you know, everyone in Libya is quite pious and Muslim. So, you know, the concept such as secularism and Islamism is slightly problematic and slightly out of kilter. But nevertheless, for the sake of discussion, the Tobruk government is more secular oriented as well. It's more nationalist oriented in a sense. But they're both pretty abysmal and you know, they're riven with corruption, riven with criminals, etc. It just, the Tobruk government is a little bit more, relative to the Tripoli junta, is more constructive in their approach to the people of the former government of the Jamhuriya. But it's much of a muchness, really. The other big players in Libya is the Zintan militia, which have under their detention, and they're treating him relatively okay. They have Saif al-Islam Gaddafi under their ownership, which is a bargaining tool for them in terms of jostling for influence in Libya. But then you have the resistance in Libya, of which there are many trends, many strands, and many factions, including the Libyan People's National Movement, which is an exile in Tunisia and Egypt of the millions of Libyan exiles who reside there now as a fallout from the war in Libya in 2011. You have the National Resistance Movement within Libya itself. You have the patriotic tribal resistance. And this is an important point, Brian, because around Daesh, a stronghold in Sirte, is actually a real popular resistance of people in Tahuna, Bani Walid, and other towns and other tribes. And the West, the NATO powers, in trying to, they're saying, pursue Daesh, but pursuing Daesh is just a cover for other strategic objectives, as I've explained. But they are just totally disregarding, they are isolating and pushing aside the actual united patriotic national resistance of the tribes and the towns and the civilians around that area. And instead, and I was just reading one of the mainstream pieces in the Western press, even the Western press admit that how can the West ally up with the ragtag death squad militia from Misrata in their said offensive against Sirte? I mean, even the article was just, you know, saying it's a laughable situation. But there is a popular resistance in Libya. It is growing in strength, but it is without strategic allies globally. So this is the main strategic problem that the Libyan people are facing in terms of trying to start on the path of recapturing their country.
Libya has, I believe, the largest oil reserves of any African country. Under Gaddafi, not only did the country play a fairly significant role internationally in terms of anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, and internationalist political orientation, but inside of Africa, certainly Libya, both financially and politically, was an anchor for the Organization of African Unity, the OAU. The U.S. government and then the U.S. media characterized Gaddafi as a brutal dictator, the absence of democracy, all of the usual colorful demonizing rhetoric for a targeted government as it tried to prepare the population, and in fact did prepare the population for the next war. Myself and other people here in the United States organized protests in cities all over the country against the Libya war, but many, many liberal and progressive people who had opposed, along with us, the terrible war in Iraq, they stayed on the sidelines. They were sort of passive or even complicit and supportive of the bombing of Libya. This time it wasn't a Republican doing the bombing. It was a Democrat. It was Obama, not Bush. Hillary Clinton said when Gaddafi was assassinated, lynched on the streets, "We came, we saw, he died." She was caught on video giddily talking about that. Talk about the real achievements of the Libyan revolution under Gaddafi. It means that you don't have to be necessarily a camp follower of Gaddafi, but there needs to be some objective faculty of what actually happened for the Libyan people from 1969 up until 2011. Talk about that, if you would.
Brian, when the Libyan Jamhuriya, I had direct relations with the Libyan Jamhuriya, with their student movement, official student movement, back in the late 90s. After the rapprochement with the West, the Libyans went a little bit quieter. They said it was they made a self-criticism in 2011 that they had gone a bit quieter with some of their alliances with radical movements in the West. But for a good part of a decade, Brian, I said nothing about Libya and Gaddafi. It was only when 2011, when, you know, I made some comments about Gaddafi teaming up with Chavez and other Global South leadership, which was positive. But for the most, you know, I didn't really comment on about it, which is a self-criticism on my part. I should have. But when Libya went to war NATO went to war against Libya in 2011, then I kind of revisited Libya, obviously, physically and conceptually and analytically. And indeed, it was just, you know, in terms of education, health, housing, and other human development in indexes, it was the best in Africa and arguably one of the best in the whole Global South. In terms of political leadership, as you mentioned, it was really strategically building the capacity of the Pan-Africanist project of the African Union with its headquarters in Sirte, as I mentioned. You know, and it was really just driving forward Global South solidarity. But also, and this is really important, that Muammar Gaddafi was the last one, the last revolutionary of a revolutionary state that had a vested interest and put into effect supporting not only Black and Asian radical movements within Europe and North America and other parts of the world, but also supporting radical working class struggles as well. He supported the miners' strike here in 84-85 in Britain. He supported the women of the waterfront, the women of the Liverpool Dockers in 1996. And can you imagine a situation where Muammar Gaddafi was still at the leadership of the Libyan revolution today, that the Libya was still united, and with this refugee and immigrant influx into Europe, that Gaddafi was still there, he would have given leadership, positive direction, not only to the immigrants and the refugees, but also the Europeans who are who are receiving them into their societies, that this is a possibility for a new revolutionary push of the European masses against capitalism, against imperialism, to unite with these refugees and immigrants. Indeed, weeks before the start of the NATO pummeling of Libya in 2011, Muammar Gaddafi had a meeting with Black radicals from North America and West Europe, including the grandson of Malcolm X, where it was an overt discussion as to how he can assist a new wave of Black radicalism in Europe and the West in general, and how Libya can be a springboard and a base for exactly that. And thank you, Brian, for the work that you and your comrades did, and the Nation of Islam, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and many other comrades in the United States. You really helped to lift the anti-war movement when so many sold out and capitulated to NATO lies and capitulated to the supremacist death squads in Libya, whose absolute signature act was the mass persecution of darker skin and Black people in Libya. And they've eradicated the only Black city in North Africa, which was Tawarga in Libya.
The Syrian government has agreed to a ceasefire. It was scheduled to take place this last weekend. The Russian government and the U.S. government said they had together worked out the ceasefire. But immediately before the ceasefire began taking place, 2 days before it began taking place, John Kerry, Secretary of State, started talking about a plan B, meaning the ceasefire might not work. That hardly seems like a full embrace of a mutually agreed upon ceasefire when you say, well, if it doesn't work before it starts, that we're going to go to plan B. And the Russian government said, well, there is no plan B. There is this ceasefire agreement. But plan B, as it's being contemplated by the media here, or some, perhaps the alternative media, is for the possible formal partition of Syria along the lines of what you're describing in Libya. In our last minute and a half, even though we've been talking about Libya, I want you to comment, if you could, about that prospect in Syria. Yes, the relationship of forces changed with the Russian intervention and recent victories by the Syrian Arab Army, the National Army of Syria. But what do you think in terms of the prospects for Syria?
Well, similarly to Vietnam in 1968, you know, the Syrians, like the Vietnamese, have won the war. It's just a case of the enemy accepting that and a snail pace withdrawal from their aggressiveness. The Syrian government has already responded saying there will be no partition of Syria. But you know, if the death squads don't respect the ceasefire, they'll be destroyed. And if they respect the ceasefire, they're in decline and they're in defeat. So whatever they do, they're going to lose. If Saudi Arabia and Turkey want to invade Syria, go ahead. There's a Russian welcoming party that's going to incinerate you straight away. So imperialism is in a lose-lose situation in relation to Syria. There are challenges, there are tricks, we got to maintain vigilance, but it's clear there will be no partition of Syria. The Syrians won't stand for it, their global partners won't stand for it, and they are absolutely towards the end of their march to victory. Really, all that remains is Raqqa and that region of Syria, and that will be relatively easily once the rest of Syria is being cleaned up very nicely. All respect to the Syrian martyrs and the Syrian people and their global partners for this absolute historic victory. This is Muammar Gaddafi's revenge. Syria is Gaddafi's revenge.
We are out of time. We've been joined by Sukant Chandan from London. He is a journalist and political commentator. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. With Donald Trump projected to win the Republican Party's nomination for president, is the Republican establishment going into high gear to prevent a Trump victory? Could Marco Rubio or perhaps one of the other candidates actually still take the nomination instead, or is it too late? To analyze this, to analyze Trump and Rubio and their domestic and foreign policies, we are joined by Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Welcome back, Daniel McAdams.
Hi, Ron. Good to be back with you.
So what do you think? Donald Trump on the march. Who would have thought 6 months ago or 8 months ago that Donald Trump could still be the front runner? He's taken three of the first four Republican primaries. The Republican establishment seems to be in a great panic and trying to find another candidate, somebody other than Trump who they could rally around. How do you characterize Trump?
Well, Trump, I think, is a classic populist. You know, he harkens back to a degree to Pat Buchanan, if you remember his 1992 campaign, where the establishment also freaked out. And I think they were able to sideline Pat because, unlike Trump, Pat didn't have a few billion dollars lying around that he could spend on the campaign. But Trump is a classic populist. He's not terribly concerned with policy. He's not beholden to the party establishment. That means he doesn't have to take their advisors that always come along with the money that's handed to candidates. So he's an absolute wild card. He's a populist. They say he's not conservative, he's not this, he's none of that. A populist is not that. They have a whole different agenda. So I think that's why the establishment is in total meltdown zone over the Trump phenomenon.
Well, I'm someone who comes from a far different place in the political spectrum than Trump, and I want to talk about this dichotomy that appears in the Trump campaign, what you call populism. I mean, Trump moved the campaign discussion, the debate, far, from my point of view, very far to the right by opening his campaign with what was essentially a stereotypical caricature of immigrants, a racist characterization of Mexicans, calling them racist, saying that they're going to build a wall like the Israeli wall in Palestine, ban Muslims, all of those kind, what I would consider to be very retrograde and divisive policies and dangerous positions. And at the same time, in foreign policy matters, Trump says, as he said the other night in the last debate before the Super Tuesday primaries, Saddam Hussein, the world would be safer with and better with Saddam Hussein in power in Iraq. The same with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, that the rise of ISIL or the so-called Islamic State is a consequence of the U.S. acting like the policeman of the world. These are clearly positions that are outside the embrace or the mainstream of either the Democratic or Republican Party establishment. I mean, here you have what I consider to be a xenophobic position for domestic popular consumption, and at the same time, a foreign policy that's anti-interventionist. What do you think?
Well, and don't forget, by the way, when you talk about giving the Republicans a panic attack, the points you listed were great, but I think the greatest one was when he said at the previous debate that George Bush and his administration knew that the Iraq war was based on a lie. They knew the WMD was a lie, and they did it anyway. And that caused an absolute nervous breakdown in the party. And I think it was, as an anti-war person myself, I think it was an absolute triumph. Although I will say I'm not a Trump voter. I'm not a voter. So I don't really have anything in the game and no skin in the game. I'm just sort of an interested observer. But with regard to this sort of the beginning, the populist beginnings, which you say that has a definitely it had the tinge of some racial aspect. It certainly was viewed that way. I think it was sort of a for better or worse, really, a remarkable ability on the part of a billionaire who, my guess, I don't know what he does with his time, but I would guess he spent more time in country clubs than in local pubs. But it sounded like he had really a sense of the pulse of the average Joe Sixpack in America, who's been told for the past however many years that Muslims are horrible and bad, no matter what the news channel, MSNBC, CNN, what have you, in different tones. Been told that Mexicans are taking their jobs, so he somehow was able to tap into this and wasn't afraid to be politically incorrect. And I think people found it refreshing. Whether they stopped to think about it is another issue, but they said, here's a guy who doesn't mince his words. And I think that was really the clue to the rise. And no matter how the establishment attacked him for being so non-politically correct, that just reinforced the attractiveness among the voter that he appealed to. So no matter how they tried to knock him down, it just emboldened him and just made him more popular. So it's hilarious to watch. As I say, I'm not a supporter, but if you can judge a person by their enemies, you certainly there's something to say for Trump. I'm just looking at a Robert Kagan editorial in the Washington Post. I think it was a few days ago. Trump is the GOP's Frankenstein monster.
I mean, Kagan is a real neoconservative. I mean,
yes.
He's the leader of neoconservatism in many ways. His wife is Victoria Nuland, who helped engineer the coup in Ukraine on February 22nd, 2014. But I want to go back because I consider what Trump has done on the domestic front, the calling on the ban of Muslims, saying, let's bring back waterboarding, we'll make it even much worse, build a wall, keep out Muslims, Mexicans are rapists. I mean, that's not populism. That's an opportunism, from my point of view, an opportunism that plays into a dangerous current of white supremacy in the United States. And the Southern Poverty Law Center a couple of days ago issued a report, and I'm not necessarily a fan of that group either, but they issued a report which documents, according to their research, that white supremacist and fascist organizations, who Trump may not be a fascist, but they are rallying behind him because of that kind of political orientation. They call him the glorious leader. And according to the Southern Poverty Law Center study, the number of white racist or Aryan race or white supremacist organizations have increased by from 800 to like 900 plus just in the last 6 or 8 months. In other words, is this Trump campaign providing fertile soil for the rise of a dangerous semi-fascist or neo-fascist movement? I think that's something that's real in America. That's what a lot of people who are organizing against Trump, they might agree about Iraq and they might agree about Gaddafi. They might think those were terrible wars. But when you have that kind of politics at home, it creates this very, very dangerous situation. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that part of that may be true. I don't put a lot of credence in the Southern Poverty Law Center for a number of reasons, but I don't think he's spawning any kind of a fascist movement. I think this kind of populism, we may not like the term exactly, but, you know, if it harkens back to George Wallace, William Jennings Bryan, there's a history of this kind of thing in American politics that reemerges. Ross Perot is another example that reemerges every few generations. And I think the establishment tries to tamp it down. The interesting thing about Trump that a lot of people scratch their head is he said these things about the wall, the Mexico wall and this sort of thing. And then he goes to Nevada and does by far the best among Hispanic voters. So there's a real disconnect between what people say will happen to him and what does happen. So I think he's touching some of these fine lines. As far as blaming the candidate for his backers, there probably is an appeal by people that have a more extremist tinge. to someone who colors outside the lines. And, you know, that was the case, you know, back when Ron Paul ran, they tried to point out that some white supremacists gave him money. And he just replied by saying, well, that's less money they'd have to spend on you know, hurting people or doing terrible things. So you can't really control your supporters. I'm not worried about a fascist groundswell. I am worried about the kind of candidate that he is, which is the kind of person that says, I'm the tough guy. I know the answers. I will get things done. And that is, that does have a sort of a Mussolini quality to it. So I think in the candidate, there are some things to be worried about. And even the bright spots, which you point out, I'm not super confident that he'll continue with them. Yeah, he says great things about not changing regimes. But then we hear that that Rudy Giuliani is one of his advisors, who's one of the most odious neocons around. And even Chris Christie, they say, is whispering in his ear. So if he starts hanging out with this crowd, he's going to change his tune even on foreign policy. So
yeah,
there's a lot to be concerned. Yeah,
yeah, that's the other thing, is that Christie has now endorsed Trump. And Giuliani, according to the reports, is forming a kitchen cabinet. It is possible that there could be, while it looked like the Republican Party establishment was consolidating around Rubio or somebody else, anybody but Trump, that in fact some parts of the political Republican establishment could block with Trump. I want to talk about, if you could, about Marco Rubio's foreign policy, because Rubio, who is, again, maybe the establishment's prime choice at this point, what would he do, say, in terms of U.S.-Cuban relations? I mean, you have a thaw, the beginning of some, not normalization of relations, the economic blockade on Cuba continues, but there is been a lessening of tensions. Obama is planning to go to Cuba. With Rubio as president, if he were to be president, how do you think that would affect U.S.-Cuban relations?
Oh, that would be a total U-turn. You know, he would jump, in my opinion, from what I've seen, he would jump into the, for lack of a better term, the Cuba mafia in Florida, the Ileana Ross Leightons, Bob Menendez types. He's not from Florida, but Bob Menendez, Ileana, these others. No, it'll be a total 180. We'll be going back to, you know, 1975 or something with Rubio. He'll can you put the genie back in the bottle? Maybe you can, but you know, U.S. policy toward Cuba had simply just caught up with reality because everyone else was trading with Cuba. But yeah, I think it'll be an about face on Cuba, definitely.
The other thing the Republican Party candidates have said, and this includes, I believe, Trump, that they are 100% against the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran, also known as the Iran Nuclear Arms Agreement, whereby Iran allowed parts of its nuclear energy program to be shipped abroad for storage purposes, and a very, very strict international monitoring through the International Atomic Energy Agency in exchange for lifting sanctions. If any of these established Republican candidates came into office, what would they do in terms of U.S. relations with Iran from your point of view?
From what we've heard, I don't think we have anything to be optimistic about. If, like me, you're in favor of normalizing relations with Iran, I think, and I have to wonder if Trump fully understands the deal, and if he did, would he still be the way he is? But he's also very anti-trade, and you know, I believe countries that trade with each other are less likely to go to war with each other. And so someone who's instinctively anti-trade, he won't look at the Iran deal like someone like I would. Saying that, yes, when we establish relations, more trade, more travel, more tourism, then we'll be less likely to go to war. He sees it in a whole different way. And is it just his rhetoric? Does he really feel this way? It's hard to tell, but certainly none of the candidates. Now, the only one that was even slightly multifaceted on these sorts of deals was Rand Paul, who, of course, is out of the race. So, is, you know, the Uber hawks are left, and a huge question mark, that is Trump.
What do you think about the Democratic Party establishment? Obviously, they have rallied behind Hillary Clinton big time. It looks as if Bernie Sanders, even though he was an outsider candidate, he was an independent, he called himself a Democratic Socialist, he had a traditional liberal policy in terms of domestic policy. On foreign policy, not that different from the Republican or Democratic Party establishment. But here again, the Democrats seem to be able to tame Sanders and the kind of populist message that Sanders has, even though he's ahead in the popular vote right now. He's got 160,000 to Clinton's 90,000. You'd never know it by the media attention, by the headlines, by the editorial writers, and by the delegate count, because the superdelegates who are beholden to the Democratic Party establishment are at least at this point saying that they're behind Hillary Clinton. Do you think that the Democratic Party establishment and the Republican Party establishment have more in common with each other, or are they really at war? Certainly the Republican Party in Congress has been at war against the Obama administration, but talk about how you view the two parties, if you would.
Well, I think the two candidates are somewhat similar in terms of how they relate to their parties, or should I say how their parties relate to them. And I'm talking about Sanders and Trump. We're absolutely certain that the other candidates of each party are going to be horrible on foreign policy. There is a chance that Trump and Sanders might be slightly less bad. So that is the one the one area of brightness. And as you say, at least on the Democrat side, they are able to, through their very arcane and strains electoral tactics or rules, are able to deny Sanders the votes that he needs, even though, as you say, the popular vote is much higher. It reminds me, it's very funny, we go around the world telling the rest of the world how they have to hold elections and which elections are valid and which ones aren't valid. And for the life of me, I can't figure out the whole concept of a superdelegate and all of these things that somehow propel Hillary despite losing, you know, couple of races so far. The other thing that is interesting, I think you'll see a split in the neocons if Hillary is the candidate. And I think you'll see the Bill Kristols and people like that will definitely go with Hillary. They'll go home to that hawkish wing of the Democratic Party. And yeah, then you'll see the Giulianis and the others will go to Trump and try to talk him into it. So that'll be something interesting to see. Maybe it's the old Leninist tactic of controlling the position in opposition. But that will be interesting to see as well.
Right now, as we are speaking, the Libyan parliament, I want to diverge for a little bit because about foreign policy. We have Hillary Clinton, who said when Gaddafi was lynched on the streets on October 20th, 2011, after a massive, massive bombing of Libya by NATO, that we came, we saw, he died. He was the sovereign head of a state, a country that was not at war with the United States. So from my point of view, not only was the war a war of aggression, a war of imperialism, it was an illegal war, a war that violated certainly the UN Charter. The Resolution 1973 did not authorize the massive bombing of Libya for the purpose of regime change. But now Libya is completely fragmented. ISIL controls part of the country. Islamic militias control other parts of the country. The U.S. government is trying to stitch together a government of national unity. It seemed to me that there was no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans when it came to the Libya war. I mean, when international foreign policy, military policy, wars, foreign wars are such a dominant part of American political life, and you have no option from either, no real alternative from within the Democratic or the Republican Party, how does that sit in terms of activating the electorate somewhere so that there's some voice of people about such life and death questions as the questions of war and peace?
It's difficult. I don't think the electoral process is very promising for Americans who are concerned with these issues. But, you know, look, the Libya question is a serious one, because this was an intervention that was Hillary's pet project. You know, it was she and a couple of people in the administration, but primarily Hillary Clinton, that wanted to do Libya and what she has created. I mean, obviously, I can't see anyone with a mind like you and I have, Brian, when it comes to war, who wouldn't argue that she's violated the Nuremberg principles and, in fact, is a war criminal for what she's done.
We're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. We've been talking to Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.